And the client said, so I'm buying this building and you're telling me to effectively destroy and throw away a big chunk of it in order to create an atrium and allow light into the building. And we said, if you don't do this, this building won't be suitable for the purpose you intended.
Welcome to the Architecture, Design, and Photography podcast, where we dig a little deeper into what motivates the creatives in these fields. Today, we are speaking with architect Patrick Costin, a principal at Canal 5 Studio in Portland, Maine. He has over 30 years of professional experience in award-winning building design, and he is a licensed architect in Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, and Massachusetts, and Illinois, and a lead accredited professional through the U.S. Green Building Council. Our interview today is sponsored by Maine Home Design, so don't miss out on Patrick's AIA Design Theory article in the upcoming February issue of Maine Home and Design. Patrick Costin, thank you for coming into the studio today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So how you doing?
Good.
Good?
Good. It's nice to be here.
Not working. It's a Friday.
It's sunny outside.
Nothing else to do as a principal of a firm on a Friday, right?
No. Friday's a good day of the week.
So, first question, I generally like to jump right into the most perplexing questions, but from what bedrock foundation of truth do you judge and create good architecture?
You are jumping into the deep end of the pool with that question.
Yeah, when you look at a piece of architecture, by what measure do you say, oh, that's no good, or wow, that's good?
I do that by how it makes me feel. And I often use the metaphor of a tuning fork, that really great architecture, meaningful architecture, beautiful architecture creates an emotional resonance in me that makes me excited and excited. I just feel the power of place and space, and in a way that doesn't happen in most of the built environment.
Right. To me, I get what you're saying, and to me, I'm not a big person on traditional or, you know, even older architecture, but that's a pretty broad and bad statement. But anyways, the Pantheon, to me, when I walked into that space, was just holy cow, you know, it's just incredible. And I get what you're saying, that there's just certain built environments that when you experience them are just, you know, incredible. They're an experience that just kind of knocks you over, which now you had, in our process of photographing some of your architecture, you had mentioned that you occasionally drag your family around and, kind of lecture them on, the built environment and architecture. And you also mentioned that, you have a photo collection. Tell me about that.
Yep. So I most often eat lunch at my desk, for better or for worse. And as part of that activity over the years, I started doing searches on different topics for imagery and collecting images. And it's probably been going on for 5 or 6 years now. And I'm somewhere in the neighborhood of over 7,000 images. And given the number of images that I've collected, I've had to, I think, develop a more and more refined sense of what makes an image powerful to me, or makes me say, click, I want to save this for later and go back to it. And increasingly, I search for images that pull me into them and are, and create, ironically, the same response I have physically when I'm out in the world and about and experience either a great public space or a powerful building or even just a room. It can operate at all those different scales, and listen to what happens in my chest. when I see something as the measure of, yeah, this is a keeper versus an image that might have interesting content or compelling content that makes for an interesting subject matter or moment, but it doesn't have the emotional hit to my chest that other images
do. And that emotional hit is coming from the photographed built environment.
Right. Sometimes it's pictures of people. Sometimes it's pictures of places. Sometimes it's pictures of objects. But they're and the thing that I've been trying to reflect on more and more to out in my own consciousness. So what is it among all these diverse images that I've collected that makes them so compelling to me? And I think some of it is probably connected to memory and experiences I've had in my life. But I also think that there are images that when composed, whether by happenstance or by intent, can amplify their emotional impact on the viewer. And that's something I'm trying to learn about so that I can hopefully use that understanding to design more meaningful and hopefully beautiful spaces that give people pleasure and enjoyment, which as opposed to simply being a functional utilitarian space.
Sure. Yeah, to me, there's what I do professionally 90% of the time is photograph architecture. And I'm always looking, when I'm composing an image, if I can, I'm trying to find a place where the viewer naturally places themselves in the image and how everything else relates to placing that person in that spot in the image and adds to the emotional feel of being in that space.
Mm-hmm.
So where, like when I walk into a room, I'm looking at where do I want to look at this room from? Where do I want to place the camera to then communicate that that's the best spot in the room to be to, so it's like a 2-point, you're kind of envisioning you want to be there, but you have to capture the idea of being there from here.
Right.
You know, and you have those two different things. And that's an interesting, for me, talking about what I do, that's an interesting way to work in capturing visuals for a very specific medium, architecture, the design and built environment, compared to images that are also extremely powerful. Like recently, in the last 5 years, there was an image, I think it was from Damascus, where this father had his daughter playing in a bathtub, and it was in a bombed out, you know, I mean, you could tell it was like rebar and everything hanging, and the wall of this building was just gone, and you were looking out at the devastation of the city. But there was this father here who had filled up the bathtub, and his little girl was just playing in it, you know? And there's just an incredible human moment there of, amongst all this, we still find joy, you know? And that's just incredibly powerful, but it's such a different visual communication and medium and moment going on there. And that's a, you know, they all connect, and they're all related to some deeper truth. But it's interesting, like when asked about what is a deeper truth that you judge the built environment by, it still comes down to the subjective feeling of it, you know? Right. And that's one thing I learned from architecture school is that there's really no right or wrong. There's just a lot of strong opinions.
Right. But I think all of us would agree that there are moments when meaning resonates in a wide range of people around a particular building or place.
Right.
And an experience I had fairly recently was I was in Connecticut and I visited a building called the Grace Foundation. It's a building designed by Sana. And it's difficult to describe, even to other architects, when I got back in town and my colleagues at the firm, what it made me feel like. But I know that I spent 2 hours walking around in silence with a whole lot of other people who, from what I could see, were doing the same thing. The building was a destination for those who had no interest in its religious function, which it was a church and a community center for a church. But the power of the building and its relationship to a beautiful setting that it was designed to harmonize with was magnetic and resonant with people who were just coming to be there because of how right. it made them feel. And for me, and we all can describe moments in our lives and places that we go to that create that kind of experience. The thing I would hope eventually to understand, or at least better understand, is how can the design process achieve to the highest extent possible that kind of outcome, even if it's very modest in its in the exercise of designing whatever that space or building or place is. And I don't have it. I don't have a formula. I haven't figured it out yet. But I think I've attuned my compass to be much more aware and sensitive to going in this direction pulls me and feels like a more meaningful direction to go in than if I turn the other way. And it's almost like what you were just describing in taking a photograph, finding it's so interesting that you go into places and you find a spot where you're in relation to the space that you're in, and it's almost like you have a dowser and you're going around the right. room, and this is where I drill for water, and right. and there are so you're looking for the same thing. You're finding that place where, in relation to what you see, it's the most meaningful experience for you.
Yeah, that is a interesting thing, that it's not until I really say it that I realize I don't know if you'd refer to it as I'm looking for the second person perspective on this. That's probably saying it wrong, but I'm looking for where the first person wants to be. It's like when we were shooting the home recently that you had designed that kitchen, you know, that's a really nice place for a person to be. But where's the best place to see that person in that space? You know, you're looking like, okay, that's the best, but then the second, where do we, right. That's an interesting way of approaching it. But like you were saying, it seems like the lowest hanging fruit to create that emotional connection to me is scale. Like scale's just, because my wife and I went to Rome for our 15th wedding anniversary, I'm pretty sure. you know, the scale of the baths to the, I believe they were to the northeast of the sea. They were gigantic, just huge, huge, huge arches. And then the scale of the ancient ruins there in the more ancient part of Rome, the scale that they built, just, you know, putting brick on top of brick, you know, was just mind blowing, but it's awe inspiring. It creates what becomes kind of an impulse to worship to a degree. Mm-hmm. You know, I get why churches are built like they are, because they take so much work and they create so much wonder. But I wonder if the easiest thing, if you can just build huge, what's the next thing that's a little more difficult but still gives you that sense of wonder, you know?
Yep.
I think you start to get more into the, you know, shape of the space, not just the size, and what that does. And we were kind of talking about that with vanishing points in photography. You know, I realize that I'm constantly putting the camera kind of in the middle of the floor plane and the ceiling plane, because then you get more symmetry, and it makes for a more powerful image. But I also wonder if it's that when you were at that level, you trusted everything more when you were a kid, a little shorter, you know, and maybe that's an emotional connection. That's all. It's all such an interesting conversation that I wish we had more time to talk about.
Yes. Yeah.
So, tell me about the most recent photograph you have that's just in your head that you just most recently saved, and why. I'd be interested to hear that.
Good question. I've been very busy lately, so I haven't been,
not as many lunches at the desk.
Been having time at lunch to search for photographs. I had an experience just the other day where I was driving to a meeting with a client, and I had I was in my car, and I remember I stopped in traffic and looking to my left, and there was a view up a street, and there was a scene that captured me at that moment that made me think I should take a picture of that, because that view, that moment, the light, even the way it was trash pickup day, and the way trash cans had been arrayed all the way up, and it went up a hill to a vanishing point, that just, I realized that's a photo I would save. That moment I would capture. And that happens hundreds, if not thousands of times during a given day where you're moving through the world, and then suddenly you either turn a corner, you see a face, you look down a street, you see a building, you see the way light moves through trees as the wind blows, all of those. It's really sort of it's experiencing the way most human beings do experience the world, which is visually, and being able to recognize when inside yourself, because I don't know how much of it is out in the world. It's this unique chemistry that happens when you walk into a building, for example, and you very quickly size up how it makes you feel, even if it's unconscious, and you experience it when it talks to you visually in the moment that you turn a corner, or you enter a room, or you see a material or a detail. It's very difficult to articulate, and architects, I think, often try hard to articulate as a way of sharing it with other professionals, these experiences and these understandings, and so that they can sharpen their ability to design more effectively and more powerfully and successfully. And they forget that non-professionals who don't have that language have those experiences too. So,
right.
So for me, one of the really great moments in my career is when I get a client who hires me to, because we share this kind of resonant relationship.
You get it.
Each other, and the client wants help from me to make happen in the physical world the experience that we both understand and value occur in whatever setting it happens to be. And that's very rare, because most commissions architecturally are much more driven by budget and functional requirements or the market. It's not a search for
beauty
experience and meaning and value and legacy. So I think, and I've only had a few experiences in my career where I've had clients like that, but they've been among the most powerful experiences I've had practicing architecture.
In studying the visual world in the way that you do and trying to capture it just in your own memories and capture it in photos that you collect, that you've seen, do you think, because you study it so much, is there an ability to lose the wonder of it because you're studying it?
Not for me. I think it's magical to me how you can capture or you can see an image or experience a place through your eyes and have it so powerfully affect you. That's really cool.
See, I listened to this interview with it wasn't Cuba Gooding Jr. It was another guy that looks very similar to him. I forget his name, but this actor was speaking on how he studies interactions of people. And the negative thing it has on his life is that it detaches him from the actual experience. Mm-hmm. That he'll be interacting with someone or watching someone else interact with someone, you know, in close proximity. And instead of allowing himself to be in the moment and experience the shared emotions and relationship, he's outside of it studying it. Mm-hmm. So he can internalize it and regurgitate it as an actor later.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And like, as you were describing what you were talking about, you don't seem, that's why I asked the question. You don't seem to be losing wonder with it, because it's, I think something that is interesting is that you're never going to find the black and white answer to beauty. It just is. But I've found in my own personal life, studying, deeper into spiritual belief in focusing on the religious aspects of it has made me lose wonder with a lot of that. Now I call it the study lose wonder effect. And
becoming an adult.
Yeah, it's a process of maturing in some ways that I don't appreciate, but I can't avoid either. It doesn't mean, you know, I lose faith completely or I don't appreciate the built environment or, you know, as I studied architecture in architecture school, I came to appreciate certain buildings less,
mm-hmm.
or at least find like, oh, wow, they really messed that one up. You know,
mm-hmm.
you started to see things more through a more well-informed lens to a degree.
Yep.
And so, you know, when someone would come with the floor plans that they did on Google SketchUp, you know, I had my dad taught in religion department in the university where I was at. And one of his one of his fellow professors brought plans that he had made on Google. Mm-hmm. And he was like, look at this. These are great. Who needs people like you? Like, just kind of joking, like, you know, as I was studying architecture, you know, and I looked at him and I didn't respond. It was just like, oh, ha-ha. And then like 5 minutes later, I'm like, well, you know, anyone can go read a Bible. Why would anyone need you? You know,
right.
He didn't get it that there's a deeper understanding in any discipline. It's kind of interesting. But so next question, design is highly influenced by social and technical changes in our culture. Things like kitchen design and residences. You know, 150 years ago, the kitchen was a separate building.
Mm-hmm.
Technical advances then made it able to have the kitchen within the house, but then it was usually separated out into a completely walled off space because you didn't want to see the mess and all that. And maybe the help or whatever, or the woman of the house back then would be the person doing that and then coming out and presenting a meal. Mm. Where now we live in a culture where it's like my house is kitchen, dining, living all in one big room. Yep. And we love it because you're not making food and being separated from everyone, and it's, you know, all together. How are the technical changes in our current society that are ramping up so quickly, how are they affecting architecture and design, in your opinion?
I think the way human beings relate to one another and the frame of human consciousness is changing because of technology. And that, an example I would offer is one of my kids is in France right now for a year. Another is away at college, but our ability to stay in touch, to see each other, to FaceTime one another, is now a commonplace reality that 10 years ago didn't exist. And the distance and time and context can be leapfrogged by technology. I have a sister that works out of her house with colleagues who are in multiple continents for multinational companies that span the globe, but she works out of her house and all she needs is a computer and a phone. That's just not something that existed 10 years ago as commonly as it does today, and it's accelerating. So to your question, I think the pace of change in the way human beings define their community, define their place in community, are in relation to both one another and to their, even amongst their own family members, is radically shifting and changing in ways that are raising the question, what's the purpose of space and place if the way we relate to one another increasingly is through digital devices that obliterate time and distance? Mm. And this came up in a conference I was at recently about the workplace, where I happened to sit next to a librarian who was there to try to understand, with all these technological changes, what is the purpose of a library? Mm. If it's not to store books,
right?
If your reference librarian is now Google, if what is a library, and is it a physical place, or is it a device in your hand that you allows you to access everything libraries used to offer you? Right. Is it a gathering place? Is it a community space? What is it? She was unclear what was happening to a profession that she had been in for over 30 years that used to be much clearer. So the changes in how Americans live at home and in the workplace are making, in my view, the nature of physical space and how we use it enter into a period of evaluation and change. Businesses are finding they can be more productive and use less space than they used to because they don't need human beings to be all together in one place to do work. And so the nature of the workplace in that sense is changing. At the same time, the boundaries between your personal life and your work life are being obliterated because you carry it around in your pocket,
right,
and it never stops. So I'm watching and trying to understand, as an architect, what the trajectory is of how space supports humans and what they need to do when what it is to be a human being and how you relate to other human beings is so rapidly evolving because of technology.
Right. Yeah. When I first started as a photographer, I kept a home office, and I would find that just after dinner, I'd go work more, you know? Mm-hmm. And towards the end of university is when, PDAs started to come in, and then smartphones eventually and all that. And it made you so much more productive, but everyone still expects you work 8 hours a day. It's not like people became more productive and then only worked 4 hours a day. You'd be a lazy slouch if you did that, you know? Mm. And we just pack more in. And I think there's definitely, and I can feel this in myself, and I don't know if everyone gets this just as they age, but, you know, just a pressure of productivity that is constantly sitting on you, you know, especially as a business owner. You just constantly have that pressure of, you know, you have to think to yourself, it's time for me to relax. I need to not think about those things. And, you know, to have the technology and all that to be able to do it at anywhere, anytime is, you know, a thing that takes a lot of self-discipline to get away from. But yeah, how does that affect the built environment? It seems like if I were going to have a home office again, I'd need to make it difficult to get to.
Right. Like, might be a shed in the backyard.
There's got to be, like, I got to walk through the snow or something, or yeah.
But. Well, and to your earlier question about how it's changing the way what a home is, the we're all becoming more accustomed to a more ad hoc, improvised, multitasking, unstructured but very demanding lifestyle. And by putting all of the living space in one big room and sharing it, the opportunity to be together as a family and to be a community, while at the same time accommodating all the different things that simultaneously have to go on, is probably a reflection of a response to the way our lives are changing.
That's interesting. Know? We're far less compartmentalized. You know, I took the kids out for dinner, but I was on my phone working the whole time, you know?
Yeah.
It's like you think you're doing it, but you're not. And just yesterday morning, I was trying to get some writing done that I was working on. And usually I'll try and sit and meditate and think by myself in the dark in the morning until the kids get up. It's like the only time I can have alone that's quiet. And it's usually my youngest son that wakes up first, 99% of the time. My oldest son woke up first, and he bolted downstairs because he was like, Grayson always gets to have time with dad alone. I'm going to get there. And this is Simon. And he came downstairs, but I was working on this writing. And so he came down and, you know, I greeted him, hugged him, but then I, you know, set up some boundaries. Like, I got to work and I got to finish this. He can't talk to me again. You know, I got to, and, you know, I could see his demeanor just really like, oh, and I didn't know that he had woken up and thought like, I'm going to get to dad first, you know?
Yeah.
I created this inavailability to dad first thing in the morning when I, you know, I could have put that aside and just done it later, but I was trying to get stuff done. And I don't think we really realize how much we often are doing that where, you know, we're at dinner, but it's like, there's this phone here and I can't, you know, and you're doing that to your kids and you're doing that to your friends and
to your spouse,
Yeah. I mean, bedtime's just, you're on your phone, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
It's, there's a lot to deal with. And I think our society will have a negative effect and we'll sense it and we'll do some self-correcting, I'm sure. So
one of the great things that Apple has done in the most recent update is provide the report,
weekly report
of how much time you're spending on your phone. And it's powerful data that I think is surprising many people.
Embarrassing.
And right.
I got a, like 3.5 hours the other day. I was like, Jeez,
that's
like
a lot of time. It makes you wonder. So where?
What could I have been getting done?
Well, right. Or if I'm on my phone that much, how am I getting all this other stuff done?
Right. You know. I mean, I think you're getting stuff done on the, I mean, I answer tons of email on my phone and all that too. So you know, that's that. But yeah. Yeah.
Anyways.
It's rumored that you have spoken on healing through design.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, one of the expertise we have in our firm is outpatient medical facilities. And
as opposed to inpatient to outpatient?
Outpatient is doctor's offices and clinics rather than the hospital.
Okay. Outpatient being hospital.
No. Inpatient is hospital. Outpatient is when you drive to see your pediatrician or your family doctor or something like that.
Got it.
But broadly speaking, healing through design is a recognition that the effect space, that space and the design of space affects well-being. And so while the healthcare industry has started to try to focus on this as another way of increasing well-being and providing better care to the people that it serves, the principles apply across the board. They apply to workspaces in general. People who work in buildings where there isn't access to natural light, where they feel like they have no control over their environment and the conditions that they're working in. Spaces that are just not supporting and conducive to human well-being affect productivity, affect well-being, affect quality of life. And so the notion of there being a checkbox in the design process that goes beyond, is the room big enough? Does it have the light switches and the outlets and the furniture and the finishes and all of these other things? But is this room a room I like being in?
What are the emotions the person will have through experiencing this room?
Exactly right. Where's the resonance of place? And the comment, there was a project that I did quite a number of years ago now, which involved renovating an existing building, but it was not suitable as an office building in its current arrangement because it had been designed actually to be a large Sears originally in the 1940s. Yeah. And so a big hole was proposed to be cut in the building to create a 4-story atrium. And the transformation was beyond dramatic. It was stupendous, the impact it had. And the client, when we first proposed this, said, so I'm buying this building and you're telling me to effectively destroy and throw away a big chunk of it in order to create an atrium space and allow light into the building. And we said, if you don't do this, this building won't be suitable for the purpose you intend it to serve. And so we did the project, and the client, perhaps a year after they had occupied the building, I ran into him, and he said, you know, all I know is every time I walk in the door of this building, I feel good. And that, to me, is we did our job.
Right.
And whether that's in someone's house or apartment or workplace or community space, that should be the objective of good design.
Kind of on that note. How do you approach design? How do you approach the design process with a client?
It starts with listening. identifying all the sort of quantitative data that will provide the frame for what we are supposed to do. So by
kind
that,
of the
I mean
objective data points that
right.
have to be ticked.
Exactly right, which include the budget, the schedule, and the scope or the program of the project. But then there's a whole nother process, which is difficult to describe because it's not a button you can push or a single question you can ask with a client to discover what are you trying to accomplish as a culture or a community or a company or a family through the construction of this building. For some, it's going to be very basic, and the notion of it elevating the human spirit will never make it to the meeting notes.
Right.
But our goal is to elevate the human spirit, not in spite of the client, but as a gift to the client for the services, as an accompaniment to the services that we provide.
Right.
And sometimes that involves careful discernment and observation and just interaction with the culture of the client, and whether family, organization, et cetera, and it takes time to do that, and it takes a lot of engagement. So what one process piece that we do utilize is structuring into the concept design phase, the earliest phases of the project, time to have those kind of unstructured conversations about, okay, you need a room this big, but what's the purpose of this room? What do you do in this room? How do you want it to support you as a person or as a family or as an organization? And how do you want to make you feel? And
do you find people kind of taken back by the question, how do you want this room to make you feel?
Yes.
Do you think that a lot of times they're like, whoa, I never thought about how I want to feel because of a space?
Well, yes. And they also, it's often very difficult for them to articulate in objective terms what the answer to that question. They don't have a language to do it because it often becomes, well, can you collect images, much like I collect images, that give us insight to what resonates with you? What makes you, what do you think would make you feel happy if that could be part of your life? This goes to the bridging between the really, architecture can be a very technical and is a very technical profession. There's a language that professionals use to achieve all the technical requirements of a building project. But there's got to be another language that allows the architect and the client to communicate effectively beyond the technical stuff. Because really, you can hire an architect. A good architect should, as a baseline, be able to execute the technical requirements of the project to the client's satisfaction.
Sure.
It's the architect being able to partner with the client in an understanding of a broader sense of goals and achievements that the enterprise is trying to address. That varies from client to client. Some clients arrive very ready and able to articulate that. Other clients are dumbfounded by that question
right.
and need a lot of help to understand how important it is that they answer it for themselves, because right. otherwise what we all experience in our profession is it will be when the building's under construction and the opportunity to significantly change course or influence the outcome of the design that has been prepared, when they walk through a space and go, oh, I didn't realize it was going to feel like this or it was going to look like this. I know I've been looking at plans, you've given me renderings, you've done all this stuff, but I didn't realize until I could walk into it that I hadn't communicated what I really wanted you to try to do for me. And
right.
And one of the great things that's happening right now with technology is, and we're implementing this in our office right now, is the ability to use virtual reality software, where the digital models that everyone uses in our profession now, which create three-dimensional digital space in the creation of our documents, we can now have people put on a pair of goggles and walk into the digital
cool.
model.
Yeah.
And we recently had that experience with our client that we're designing an expansion to their office space for. And we had one of the executives in our office, and we were getting a demonstration of this technology, and we said, hey, check this out. So I actually, it's in our building. So I went and got him and I said, come here, you need to see this, because we were walking around in his future office space. And he was so excited about it. He thanked us, said, this is great. I didn't understand as well as I now understand, and I'm excited because it's what I want. And about 15 minutes later, he came back with the president of the organization and said, here, put the goggles on him too.
You gotta do this too.
And he walked around and he was like, this is great. I now understand
right.
what the outcome of all this is going to be. So
right.
that is a very bright future, I think, for both the architect and the client to better able to communicate to one another what they're trying to do
right.
together.
It's always been an interesting balance in my own profession to understand that your technical capabilities serve what people are paying you for, right? So if,
yeah.
if you're going to limit yourself to making buildings that stand up and hold the weather out and keep a person warm, you're very much going to limit yourself in, you know, the amount of money you can make, the exorbitant fees that you can charge, because the, you know, the technical aspects can be taught, and there are boxes that can be checked. It's not that crazy difficult, but it's the feel that if you can create a feel that translates, that's when you become a like, that's amazing. I want that.
That's right.
You know, and I saw that in my own work as a photographer, where many times I'd fall short on technical things, and I'd make sure to brand those mistakes into my head.
Mm.
But I did them because I was reaching for the feel, you know, and it I pay really close attention when I come up short on things for technical purposes, and I do get geeky about technical things, but I know at the same time that the feel is what you're being paid for, you know.
That's right.
And that's where you get the ability to sell it. So that's an interesting thing that you kind of communicated there in your process, is like you tick all those objective boxes, but then you walk into that very nuanced conversation of trying to understand what a person is looking for when they can't even tell you exactly what it is. Sometimes mm-hmm. you try and understand the feel that they want, or you at least educate them to a point of understanding that you should be considering that you will be given a feeling by a building. You may not even understand it yet, but like your client came back to you and said, like, we don't want to put a big donut hole in the middle of our building. But then later they say, I don't know what it is, but every time I walk in here, I feel great. You know,
right.
like success. You
yeah.
you know, you did the right thing. Last question. What makes a great building for you? Or successful building for you is the actual question.
I think it's when it stops me in my tracks. Yep. You know, because for me, it could be an 800-year-old building, it could be a 1500-year-old building, or it could be a building that was finished yesterday. I don't think design is, how do I articulate this? I think when I feel wonder and awe and a sense of astonishment at the power a building or place has on how I experience the world, that's a great building. That's a great design. And sometimes it's accidental and unintentional. Sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it, perhaps as an architect, I'm not being very articulate, I guess, and I'm using words that are again, reach into the realm of how something affects me emotionally and communicates in a way that is really meaningful to me. I'm really at a loss for words here for a moment. You earlier referenced walking into the Pantheon and the impact it had on you. I had the same experience when I walked into the Pantheon. You move in, you look up at the big oculus, you feel the scale and the power of that space inside of yourself, and you just stop and you look and you're like, wow, this is incredible. And that for me is what I'm trying to do as an architect as much as I can. And you know, it's really interesting. All of us, I think, as human beings, strive to have that kind of experience woven into the fabric of our lives. And so much of your experience isn't of that caliber, or it's, and so it's the exception and not the rule, but how do you make the exception of experiencing really powerful and beautiful and meaningful places and spaces a greater proportion of your life? And and I think my work as an architect over my life has been to try to increase the percentage of opportunity that exists in the world to elevate what it means to be a human being in the world through the built environment. It's so challenging to find the conditions that allow you to even try to do a great building. So much of it is dependent, is beyond the control of the architect.
Yep.
And in the hands of primarily the client, that when you get those opportunities, you really want to pour your heart and soul into the effort to take advantage of that opportunity. And then you want to seek to position yourself to have more opportunities like that. And the great work that firms do in the world often is a product of having hit a home run with a great building, and it attracts the clients that gives that opportunity, that architect, the opportunity to try to hit another home run. Right. And there are great architects who never get that opportunity.
Yeah.
And but it's, I think it's something that animates and drives and pulls into the profession people who want to practice architecture.
Right. Yeah, it's, have you been to the Exeter Library?
Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. The, I'd walk right past it and not even think about going in from the exterior, but you walk inside and it's that moment of wonder that just hit it. It'll knock you on your back.
Oh.
It's just,
oh, yeah.
I think it's all marble staircases. If I remember, when you like come in the door and it's like, what's that? And then you look up and it's just
a heroic space.
Just incredible. Yeah. It's a similar, thing with the circle, and sphere of the Pantheon, you know, built into the interior of that. But yeah, that awe-inspiring wonder that someone did something there. And like you're saying, the difficulty of making stuff like that happen, it's another interesting but separate conversation around the personalities that will rise to that level. They have to have the combination of the ability to aesthetically see what something can be, but then they have to have the fortitude to push a client to that place, and they will often be very unpleasant people to be able to get those, you know. And you look at, you know, the Steve Jobs, the Frank Lloyd Wright, their lives are just horrendous, but they achieve these great things. And for me, it's very reflective to consider that, like, you know, who do I want to be? And, you know, in considering what I want to get done, but knowing the risk you take at the person you become to achieve that, that's a really interesting for the next conversation, maybe.
Yeah. Well, after Christmas, we're going to Bilbao to see the Guggenheim Museum.
I'd love to come. Thanks.
Kind of, yeah. As
I'll
a pilgrimage.
Tag along photographer.
There you go. And I, there are many people in my profession who I have said that, you know, Frank Gehry, his stuff, I just don't. I've always admired Gehry's work, and I get it. I get it. And so I'm very excited to go to Bilbao and see this building, but I know what led to the creation of that building in significant parts is because Frank had a client that wanted him to design him a house, a very, very wealthy man, and he worked on it for about 10 years and was paid, in effect, to do all kinds of research and development on many of the techniques and design elements that, when he got the commission to do Bilbao, he never built the house. The client spent 10 years paying him to design it. It changed, you know, probably 100 times. And then he said, you know what? I'm at this stage of my life, I don't need this big, expensive, crazy house. I'm not going to build it. But then he got the opportunity to do the Guggenheim in Bilbao, and the ideas and the research and the thinking was able to all go
right
into
over
that building. And I'm in terms of emotion, I have read that when Philip Johnson went to see the Guggenheim for the first time, his response was to burst into tears. That the emotion of that place and building overwhelmed him, and I hope I have a similar experience when I see
all
it.
Right. You're gonna have to YouTube that, do some crying architecture tours.
There you go. Yeah.
Have you seen Frank Gehry's, I think it was his first house that he owned, that he personally like renovated
and
tore apart.
I have not seen it, no.
I mean, it's got like chain link fence. Yeah, the photographs.
Yeah.
And he like just cut like right through part of it, and there's just exposed structure and framing from this old house, and extremely just out there. But, you know, you can see where it led him, where he came from, and where it took him. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
But it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming in. Really appreciate it. And be sure to catch Patrick's article in the February issue of Main Home Design, an AIA Design Theory article. And again, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.